Usually when we talk about a medical rule, there's this expectation of absolute permanence.
Right, like it's etched in stone.
Yeah. It's treated almost like gravity.
Right.
Like you don't put a cast on a sprained ankle, you don't give penicillin to someone with a known allergy.
Definitely.
And for the last 2 decades, you never, ever give psilocybin to someone with bipolar disorder. I mean, the fear was always that it would, like, a lit match in a powder keg.
A total disaster.
Right, triggering these catastrophic, life-destroying manic episodes.
It was essentially a closed book in modern psychiatric research. Like, if you were setting up a clinical trial for psychedelics, the very first thing you did was screen out anyone with a bipolar diagnosis.
Just automatic
Oh,
disqualification.
completely. It wasn't even a debate. The risk of inducing mania was considered so severe that keeping those patients out of the trials was, well, it was a foundational feature of how the science was conducted.
But then you step away from the established rules and you look at the actual emerging neurobiology, and suddenly that solid, unbreakable rule starts to, well, it starts to shatter.
It really does.
We are currently looking at a scientific landscape that just experienced a massive earthquake. We're doing a deep dive today into a brand new article from the OOTW Journal.
Hot off the presses.
Literally. Published just 2 days ago, on June 4th, 2026. The piece is titled Psilocybin and Bipolar Disorder, the Field's Hardest Open Question.
And honestly, it truly is the hardest open question right now because the data we are starting to see, it completely contradicts the fundamental safety assumptions the field has operated on since the mid-2000s.
Wow.
We're essentially having to rethink what the drug actually does to the bipolar brain.
Exactly. So our mission for this deep dive is to explore how a groundbreaking 2024 clinical trial completely broke this 2-decade rule. We're going to explore why the underlying neuroscience suggests psilocybin might actually target the root of bipolar disorder.
Which is fascinating, isn't
Right.
it?
Even better than a target standard unipolar depression. And this is crucial. For anyone paying attention to this space, we're going to look at why mixing it with one very specific gold standard bipolar medication creates a highly dangerous chemical reaction.
That part is so important.
Yeah. For you listening, we are promising a clear, hype-free unpacking of a massive shift in psychiatric science. No miracles, just the data.
Which is exactly the lens we need to use here. I mean, the data from the trial you mentioned, the Aaronson trial, it's staggering, but it requires incredibly careful interpretation before anyone just jumps to
Okay,
conclusions.
let's unpack this.
Yeah.
December 2023 online, hitting print in June 2024, the journal JAMA Psychiatry publishes a trial by Scott Aaronson and his team at the Sheppard Pratt Institute.
Right.
And they did what was previously considered totally unthinkable. They took 15 adults suffering from highly chronic, treatment-resistant bipolar II depression, and they gave them a 25 milligram dose of synthetic psilocybin.
And we should probably pause here to emphasize what treatment-resistant bipolar II depression actually means for the people living with it.
Good point.
These weren't individuals who just had, a couple of bad weeks. These participants had failed an average of 4 prior medications.
Wow. Four.
Yeah, they were stuck in a deeply entrenched, heavy depressive phase.
And the treatment protocol wasn't just like handing them a pill and sending them home, right?
Oh, not at all. It was embedded in heavy psychotherapy. The protocol required 3 preparation sessions just to get the patients ready.
Okay.
Then an 8-hour dosing day with 2 therapists present the entire
Two
time.
therapists for the whole 8 hours.
Exactly. And then 3 integration sessions over the following 2 weeks to, help them process the experience.
So massive guardrails.
Massive.
But the numbers that came out of this are what I really want you, the listener, to focus on. At week 3, their depression scores, which were measured by something called the MADRS scale, they dropped by 24 points.
Right. And to give that 24-point drop some context, the MADRS scale measures the severity of depressive symptoms.
Okay.
A 24-point drop isn't just feeling a little brighter. It is often the difference between being entirely unable to get out of bed or function and actually resuming a normal, engaged life. It's a profound clinical shift.
That really puts it into perspective. And the study found that 80% of the participants responded to the treatment, and 73% hit full remission.
Meaning the depression was basically gone.
Just gone. But the stat that completely stopped me in my tracks was the effect size.
Yeah.
They calculated a Cohen's d of 4.5, 4.08.
Yeah, that number is wild.
And I know effect sizes can get a bit mathematically dense for a deep dive.
Yeah.
But how should we be looking at a number that high?
Well, in psychiatric statistics, we use Cohen's D to measure how big of a difference a treatment makes compared to a baseline or a control group.
Right.
A score of 0.2 is small, 0.5 is medium, and 0.8 is considered a large effect.
So 4.08 is roughly four times the threshold for what scientists already consider a large effect.
It's astronomical.
It's like registering a magnitude 9 earthquake in a zone where researchers were previously terrified to even walk. The article notes it is one of the largest effect sizes ever recorded in a depression intervention study.
Ever.
And crucially, they measured for mania at every single visit. Zero hypomanic switches.
Yep.
Zero suicide attempts. So I have to ask, if the results are this astronomically good, why were these patients universally excluded from trials since 2006?
It comes down to what we call an asymmetry of harm.
Okay, what does that mean?
Well, historically, going all the way back to Sidney Cohen's survey in 1960.
Right, the one that looked at early LSD and mescaline users.
Exactly. And continuing through decades of anecdotal case reports, there was a really well-documented signal of psychedelics triggering manic reactions and suicide attempts.
Right, okay.
And you have to understand, a manic episode isn't just having a lot of energy. It is a severe medical event that can ruin a person's finances, their career, their relationships.
It just detonates their life.
It does. It can take months, sometimes years, to recover from the fallout of one episode.
So researchers essentially said, we don't have modern clinical safety data. The potential downside is catastrophic, so we just have to keep them out.
That's it. When researchers running the first modern trials at Johns Hopkins and Imperial College were designing their studies, they made the theoretically correct ethical choice.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Without trial-grade safety data, you keep bipolar patients out.
Better safe than sorry, based on historical case reports. But the OOTW article points out we now have observational data of what happens out in the wild.
Yes, the new data is really shifting things.
Right. There's this 2023 survey by Morton that looked at 541 self-reported bipolar individuals who took psilocybin on their own, outside of a clinical setting.
Out in the wild, basically.
Exactly. And the numbers show that 14.2% reported mania symptoms and 3.3% required emergency services.
Right.
Now, I have to push back on the enthusiasm here for a second. 14.2% is roughly 1 in 7 people.
It is.
If I told you a roller coaster had a 1 in 7 chance of putting you in the hospital, you wouldn't call that a green light. You wouldn't ride it. Why is the field treating this survey as a reason to move forward?
I completely hear the roller coaster analogy, and honestly, 14% is a number that demands immense respect.
Yeah.
But you have to consider the baseline risk of what these patients are already experiencing. Severe treatment-resistant bipolar depression carries a massive mortality risk just on its own.
Oh, that's true.
What the 14% figure establishes is a bounded risk. It debunks the implicit myth that terrified the field for decades, this idea that psilocybin universally and reliably destabilizes anyone with a bipolar diagnosis.
Oh, I see. It's not an 80% or 90% manic switch rate.
Okay, exactly. It's 14%.
Okay, I see. So it's a specific vulnerability for some, not a universal guarantee for all.
Precisely. And this is exactly why Aronson's trial succeeded without triggering any mania. They didn't just throw psilocybin at anyone who walked through the door with a bipolar diagnosis.
Right, filter them out.
Very carefully. They used extreme guardrails to specifically weed out that 14% risk profile. They only enrolled bipolar 2 patients, meaning people who experience hypomania, which is a milder form, rather than full-blown mania.
Right.
They excluded anyone with a history of psychotic features, recent rapid cycling, or active substance use. They essentially sliced out the lowest risk segment of the bipolar spectrum.
Okay, so the extreme guardrails explain how they avoided the risks and didn't trigger catastrophe.
Hmm.
But that only explains why the patients didn't get worse.
Right.
It doesn't explain why their depression vanished so completely.
Hmm.
What is psilocybin actually doing inside a bipolar brain that makes it so wildly effective?
This is where we shift from the clinical trial data to the foundational neurobiology.
My favorite part.
There is a 2015 meta-analysis by Fernandez that looked at nearly 6,500 participants.
Huge sample.
Very huge. And it found that bipolar disorder features a foundational deficit of a specific protein called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF.
Okay, BDNF. From what I understand, it's basically the brain's fertilizer. Right? Like, it helps promote the growth, survival, and plasticity of neurons.
That's a great functional description. But what's crucial in the Fernandez data is that this BDNF deficit isn't just present when the patient is in a depressive phase.
Wait, really?
Yeah. It is present in both the manic and depressive poles. It's a structural, biological flaw underlying the entire disease.
Okay, let me see if I'm visualizing this right for our listeners. If we think of bipolar disorder as a garden, we usually treat the weather, right? Like the scorching manic summers and the freezing depressive
Yeah,
winter.
the mood swings.
Exactly. We give medications to stabilize the weather. But this BDNF data says the real problem is the soil itself. The soil is completely nutrient deficient regardless of what season it is.
That is an excellent way to frame it. You are dealing with impoverished soil, and here is where it connects directly to psilocybin. A 2023 paper in Nature Neuroscience by Molinar showed that psilocin, which is the active compound that psilocybin breaks down into once it's in your body, it binds directly to the TRKB receptor.
TRKB?
Yes, and that is the exact receptor that BDNF uses to do its fertilizing work.
And how strong is that connection? Like, how well does it bind?
Well, the study found psilocin binds to that receptor with roughly 1,000 times the potency of ketamine, which is another drug known for its rapid antidepressant effects.
1,000 times.
It's incredibly potent.
So psilocin acts as this incredibly potent targeted fertilizer that binds directly to the root system of our deficient soil.
Exactly.
It's fixing the soil, not just trying to change the weather. This means the pharmacological logic for giving psilocybin to a bipolar patient is actually biologically cleaner and more direct than giving it to someone with standard unipolar depression.
Mechanistically, yes. It directly addresses the most reproducible biological deficit in the bipolar brain.
But wait. As I was reading through the pharmacology and the source material, I noticed a massive glaring contradiction.
Oh, I bet I know which one.
If we look at the receptors, this treatment seems like a terrible, terrible idea.
You're touching on the serotonin paradox.
Exactly. The standard drugs used to stop mania in bipolar patients, the atypical antipsychotics, they work by blocking a specific serotonin receptor called the 5-HT2A receptor.
Correct.
But psilocybin does the exact opposite. It stimulates or agonizes that exact same receptor. Yeah. So by pure pharmacological logic, if blocking the receptor stops mania, stimulating it with a psychedelic should cause a massive manic episode. Why didn't it?
It's a brilliant question, and the answer basically comes down to the dimension of time.
Time.
Yeah. Atypical antipsychotics work by blocking that receptor chronically day after day over weeks and months. Psilocybin, on the other hand, delivers an acute, highly intense 4 to 6 hour pulse of stimulation.
So how does a temporary intense pulse lead to long-term relief without causing mania?
Think about what happens when you walk from a dark room out into the bright sunlight. Your pupils immediately constrict to protect your eyes, right?
Right, yeah.
The brain does something similar at the cellular level. When you stimulate that serotonin receptor that intensely and that quickly with psilocybin, the brain reacts by pulling those receptors inward.
Oh, like hiding them?
Exactly. It's a process called internalization, and it downgrades their sensitivity for days or weeks afterward.
Oh, wow. So the immediate psychedelic trip is a stimulant, but the aftermath, the therapeutic window, is actually a downgraded, quieted state.
Yes. The post-acute phase actually mimics the receptor signature of a mood stabilizer much more than a stimulant.
That makes so much sense.
But to fully understand why it treats the depression without triggering mania, we have to zoom out from individual receptors and look at the brain's network level, specifically the default mode network, or DMN.
Right, the DMN. That's the network that essentially governs our internal monologue,
right,
our self-reflection, and our rumination.
Exactly. Now, in bipolar II depression, neuroimaging shows that the default mode network is in a state of hyperconnectivity.
It's too active.
It is far too rigid, locked in overdrive, which drives that endless depressive rumination. Psilocybin has been shown to break down that rigid hyperconnectivity, allowing the network to basically relax and reset.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because this perfectly explains why you cannot treat bipolar I and bipolar II the same way.
Precisely.
If bipolar II depression is a network that is too tight, what does the network look like in bipolar I mania?
In bipolar I mania, the default mode network already shows severe hypoactivity. It's already too loose, fragmented, and disconnected.
So if you give psilocybin to a bipolar I patient in a manic state, you're further relaxing a network that's already dangerously loose. It would be like pressing the accelerator on a car that already has broken brakes.
That is a very apt analogy. And that is exactly why the do not give psychedelics to bipolar I rule remains the absolute standard of care. The positive data we are discussing applies to bipolar II depression specifically.
And even if you have the correct type of bipolar disorder for this treatment, there is a hidden trapdoor that we need to make crystal clear.
Yes, we really do.
For you listening, this is incredibly important. Mixing psilocybin with the standard medication for bipolar disorder is phenomenally dangerous.
We are talking about lithium.
Yeah.
In 2021, a researcher named Sandeep Nayak analyzed a massive database of case reports and self-reported psychedelic experiences. He was looking for interactions between classic psychedelics and bipolar medications.
And the signal he found for lithium was terrifying.
It really was.
47%.
Yeah.
Nearly half of the published cases involving someone mixing lithium with a classic psychedelic like LSD or psilocybin resulted in seizures.
It's a huge number.
We aren't just talking about a bad trip here. We are talking about medical emergencies. Why is that combination so toxic?
It has to do with how the two chemicals alter brain state. Lithium already lowers the brain's seizure threshold. Meanwhile, psychedelics significantly increase cortical excitability. They make the outer layers of the brain highly active.
Okay, so they clash.
Exactly. When they meet, they multiply each other's effects, creating a perfect storm for a seizure. Interestingly, the data showed that lamotrigine, another very common mood stabilizer, had zero seizure signal. It appears safe. But lithium is an absolute hard stop.
Which creates an unbelievable trial design paradox. Lithium is the most evidence-based effective mood stabilizer we have. It's the gold standard.
Yeah. It is.
But because of this absolute contraindication, if you want to run a clinical trial to see if psilocybin helps bipolar patients, you have to exclude anyone taking the most standard treatment for the disease.
It's an enormous bottleneck. The empirical population you can actually study is restricted to bipolar tachyectic patients who are either taking lamotrigine, taking nothing, or willing to undergo a full medication washout under supervision.
Which is incredibly hard.
It is. But that's exactly what Aronson's trial did. It radically narrows the frame of who this treatment is actually proven for right now.
And because of limitations like the lithium exclusion, we have to transition into what the scientific community still doesn't know. We have to temper this excitement with rigorous reality.
Always a good idea.
Aronson 2024 was groundbreaking, but at the end of the day, it was only 15 people.
Right. Statistically, a 15-person cohort is just a pilot study. When you have a sample size that small, your confidence intervals are very wide.
Meaning the margin of error is big.
Exactly. The trial reported zero hypomanic switches, but statistically, with only 15 people, a 95% confidence interval means the true population rate of manic switches could theoretically still be up to 20%.
Wow, okay.
Plus, we have to remember it was an open-label trial.
Meaning everyone knew they were getting the drug, there was no placebo group, and the placebo response in bipolar depression can be huge, right?
It can be up to 50% in some cohorts, according to data from Cisco in 2007.
50%?
Yeah. So while a Cohen's D of 4.08 is extraordinary, we have to assume that part of that massive effect is partially driven by the fact that everyone knew they were getting the treatment, combined with all that intense therapeutic support.
Right. We won't know the true isolated chemical effect size until a large, randomized controlled trial is completed.
Precisely.
There is also the problem of the time horizon. Bipolar 2 has a natural rolling cycle. People naturally swing from depression to hypomania over the course of 12 to 24 months.
Right.
But the Aronson trial only followed up with patients for 12 weeks.
Which is nowhere near long enough to know if psilocybin causes delayed cycle acceleration.
Oh, like speeding up the cycle.
Exactly. Sure, they weren't manic at week 12. But what if the drug accelerated their underlying biological architecture and they hit a severe hypomanic phase at month 6 or month 12?
Because standard antidepressants are known to induce rapid cycling in bipolar patients, right?
Yes, they are. We simply do not have the long-term data to rule that out for psilocybin yet. Future trials, like the RCT starting at the University of British Columbia that won't read out until 2028, those are explicitly designed to monitor this long-term trajectory.
Okay, as I was reading through the source material, I had a massive realization about the diagnostic blurriness of this whole field.
Oh, the misdiagnosis issue.
Yes. The article cites data from Hirschfeld showing that 50% to 75% of bipolar patients are initially misdiagnosed with unipolar depression. And they often carry that incorrect diagnosis for a decade.
Yes, it's a known structural flaw in how psychiatry operates.
Why does that even happen?
Well, think about human behavior. People go to the doctor when they are severely depressed and suffering. They rarely go to the doctor complaining that they feel fantastic, are super productive, and need less sleep, which is what hypomania feels like.
That makes total sense. They don't report the highs.
Exactly. So the doctor only sees the depressive pole, diagnoses unipolar major depressive disorder, and prescribes standard antidepressants.
Wait, wait. If 50 to 75% of bipolar patients are initially misdiagnosed as having unipolar depression,
Yeah.
does that mean that the famous unipolar depression psychedelic trials from the last 5 years probably already included a bunch of covert bipolar two patients?
It is highly probable, honestly, almost mathematically certain. The foundational 2022 New England Journal of Medicine trial that proved psilocybin works for treatment-resistant depression excluded bipolar patients using a standard psychiatric screening interview.
Right.
But as the Hirschfeld data shows, those interviews miss the hypomanic history up to 75% of the time.
That is wild. The data showing psilocybin works for bipolar 2 was likely already sitting there in the unipolar trials. We just had the wrong labels on the folders.
Exactly. It's very likely that some fraction of the phenomenal multi-month remissions we've celebrated in the unipolar literature were actually treatment effects in covertly bipolar 2 patients.
So what does this all mean? If we wrap up all these complex threads, the staggering 4.08 effect size, the BDNF soil fertilizer mechanism, the
Where?
default mode network differences, and the absolute danger of lithium.
It's a lot to synthesize.
It is. The main takeaway for you listening is that a headline like psilocybin cures bipolar is a dangerous oversimplification.
Highly dangerous. The truth is incredibly stratified. The evidence currently supports a very specific narrow claim. Psilocybin might be a revolutionary treatment specifically for bipolar 2 depression in patients without psychotic features who are completely off lithium, administered in a highly controlled single-dose clinical setting.
Wow, that is a lot of caveats.
It is. It is the field's next great hypothesis. It is not yet an established cure you should try at home.
It's precision medicine, not a magic bullet. But I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to mull over, building on that misdiagnosis realization.
Okay.
We started this deep dive talking about the expectation of medical precision, like an X-ray showing a cleanly broken bone. Psychiatry isn't like that. It relies on checklists of symptoms.
Very true.
But what if psychedelics change that entirely? If a drug like psilocybin acts as a chemical stress test that reveals undiagnosed bipolar patients hidden inside unipolar depression trials,
Oh, I see where you're going.
and if the neuroscience of the BDNF deficit links both poles of the disease down at the root level, will the psychedelic era force psychiatry to completely redraw the map of how we diagnose and categorize mood disorders in the first place? Could the drug itself and how the brain reacts to it become the diagnostic tool we've been waiting for?
That is a profound thought. It heavily suggests that our current diagnostic checklists might be entirely inadequate for the neurobiology we are finally beginning to uncover. We might need a whole new framework.
A completely new way to look at the soil. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the consensus, keep looking deeply at the data, and we will catch you next time.